Let me get this recording going. All right. All right. Now we go.
Okay. Okay. Got it. All right. So, whether, you know, I've been interested in talking with you about your trip to Europe, which you've obviously discussed in terms of what actually happened and the content, meeting people, things like that. But I would, every now and then you would let slip some idea about your observations of the actual European scene, as far as both the culture and the state of Christianity as you saw it, and of course you only went to
Netherlands, Germany, the Netherlands, and Germany. England.
Right. And did you pass through Belgium in the middle of the night trying to get to that ferry?
No, actually, we went right back to Job's place in the Netherlands. We never wound up at the ferry terminal. Vendong thought he could talk our way on, and Job and I said, no, we're going back to Job's house.
Right.
You were there for that crazy
night. Yeah, that was a crazy night. I heard you guys making plans to try to, you know, it's like suddenly, and I'm sitting there, I'm, you know, I could teach you a master class on traveling through Europe, because I just figured it out. I've done it about 10 times, and not small trips either. Some of them are 3 months or more long. I think I've done them 6 months long, if I don't include just all the time I've spent here in Tbilisi. But I remember I was, I think, 23 years old when I first went to Europe, you know, coming from California for the first time. And I only got to England, Switzerland, and France, even though I stayed a year at Le Brie. But I was mostly at Le Brie rather than traveling. But it made a huge impression on me. And I was interested in comparing notes, talking about the European scene. And I assume one of the topics that'll probably come up is just talking about impressions of, you know, comparing American Christianity to European Christianity and things like that.
Yeah. I wish I had done, when I was in Europe, I was just brimming with observations and thoughts and ideas. And you get back to the US and it's like, okay, I've been gone for 3 weeks and now suddenly I have to catch up. And I had a week before I had to go to Thunder Bay. I'd never been to Europe before. And obviously growing up in the Christian Reformed Church, so many Dutch connections to Europe.
Right.
The Christian Reformed Church was really up until probably the 80s, you know, still remained a very Dutch subculture within the United States and Canada, and mm-hmm. Dutch foods, Dutch words, all of that Dutchness. So going to the Netherlands was very interesting, although I'd always grown up hearing from immigrants from the Netherlands, kind of this woeful, you know, it's not like it used to be. And so immigrants always sort of freeze the culture that they leave and they preserve it. I don't know where you want to start in terms of faith and then England and the UK and Ireland. I didn't, you know, one of the regrets of the trip was I didn't get to spend enough time in Germany. I had some really wonderful conversations with Germans in Germany about Germany, although Germany at the festival was full of a lot of students from all over who are studying in Germany, which is a whole nother dynamic of these European countries as, you know, it in some ways it's the globalization of Europe that's been happening. Mm-hmm. I remember when we got to London, you know, we were taking the tube around and it's like, wow, it reminds me to a degree of New York City, because here's a cosmopolitan. This is not, you know, puddings and Englishness and all of that. This is a cosmopolitan city that is full of people from all over the world.
Yeah.
So I don't know where, there's a ton to talk about.
I think that people who are Anglophiles in America tend to, you know, if they're Christians, they're reading C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, and they're getting, you know, some sort of feel about Oxford or whatever from there. If maybe they're reading Jane Austen and they have this other sense, or, you know, there's this these images that we have of different places. And I remember when I first went to England was the first place I went to. And there were still men walking around with bowler hats in 1978. It was also the beginning of the punk scene. And so you'd see these punks with mohawks and pink hair and such then, which had a very different meaning than the colored hair you see now. But I remember getting to Oxford and, you know, and I've, you know, got my C.S. Lewis goggles on and walking by the Bodleian Library, the huge library there that has everything, but they wouldn't let me in because I'm not, you know, a student or anything. But just hearing out of some student's dormitory, the Bee Gees staying alive, and I'm going like, what happened? You know, and that was 78, you know, but it was just this idea. And now when I look back, it's like, oh, yeah, things were a lot more British then, you know. Yeah. But the idea, I just couldn't put it in my brain, you know, disco, Bee Gees with Oxford. It was just like, how are these in the same world?
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, one of the early podcasts on The Rest is History was on Americanization, and that podcast really helped give me a little bit of an orientation. And then when I got to the Netherlands, the impact of globalism and American culture on Europe was dramatic. I remember even just when starting the channel, talking to Job, and the quality of the English in the Netherlands. And Job was like, you know, I grew up watching American cartoons, you know, American television, American movies. And so in that sense, Europe wasn't wholly alien.
Right.
Yet, I was in how small it was. I mean, just compared to living my whole life or most of my life in the United States, where you can drive here in the West Coast, we drive a long ways quite regularly without thinking anything of it. And there you're just, you know, all these little, you know, even enclaves within a very small country like the Netherlands. And then, you know, whoops, you're over the border into Germany. And now, of course, you've got the Euro through much of it. You don't have any border checkpoints between many of the countries.
Right.
So, and then just noticing how, listening to the Dutch talk about the Germans and listening to the Germans talk about the English. And it's like, you know, y'all are living in a pretty small space here, and you fought a lot of wars that, you know, even Americans have an idea of the history of, and yet you're still trash talking each other. I'm not sure you should do that. And so it's a very interesting cultural dynamic between all these little countries that Americans look at, and it's like, wow. Let's stay out of European wars.
Get a bit further and go east and show up in the Czech Republic or Poland or Hungary. Oh yeah, there's trash talking going on. And the Czechs, for instance, you know, it's just like, what do they think of the Germans? Not too much. What do they think of the Poles? They're like us, but they're too Catholic. And what do you think of the Austrians? We don't want to. You know, it's like, and you have all of these, in a sense, sibling rivalries, but, you know, it goes a lot deeper than that. And one of the things that has always struck me about Europe, and it struck me more and more over the years as I've traveled, is that Americans, you know, we've been talking about deconstruction and such, and the Europeans have to in their way as well. But the Americans can actually deconstruct the reality they live in, because Americans really don't care about history. And so if you just plow something under and put a new shopping mall or something there in its place, nobody actually cares. Whereas in Europe, you have all these ancient buildings that, you know, churches predominantly, but then town halls, old squares, and all of these things. And you just can't plow that stuff up. You know, nor can you plow up the culture that created it in the same way, even though you can certainly argue that America is a lot more Christian in certain ways than Europe is. Europe's got it in the foundations.
Yeah. And that, so I got to the Netherlands and I got to the Netherlands and I noticed I'm working from this brand new computer and I have to turn off my family chat or they're going to drive me to it. Okay, here we go. So one of the early things that I did in the Netherlands was I did this podcast with the New World, which I have to post on my channel at some point. And it was not a Christian podcast. I knew nothing of it. A couple of the people, John Van Donk and a couple of the other people in the Netherlands said, oh, we want to get you on there. And they actually did, which was surprising because the guy says, we usually don't take people who volunteer for the podcast. I thought I didn't volunteer for this podcast, but it was really wonderful conversation. And, you know, he asked me about, you know, coming from America, how, you know, what it was like to visit such a secular country. And I thought, oh, good grief, America's way more secular, but is it or isn't it? And right. And because, like you say, it's there in the stones, it's there in the bones, and it's so deep. Christianity is so deeply embedded and rooted there that in some ways the people are just sort of skating above it, whereas America, you know, they're still sort of swimming in it in some ways. And it's, yeah, the whole question of to what degree is secularity actually Christianity light is deeply interesting in Europe, especially now as these countries, which were, you know, for most of their history ethnically defined, now suddenly become part of globalization, and you have, you know, large numbers of Islamic immigrants and African immigrants, you know, to sufficient degree to begin to really change cultures and change politics. And of course, in you'll probably know, you know, I paid a lot more attention to European politics since I've been there. You know, some of the conversations in England over Brexit. I've just been, my wife and I have been watching Borgen, which is a Danish, it's a Danish television show that you can watch on Netflix. It's basically about a woman who becomes prime minister. And right. Now having been in Europe, it's just fascinating watching these, and this was in the early teens, like 2011, 2012. So it's right. The history, the politics have moved on since then, but yeah, I look at Europe and think, America, everyone in Europe talked about America as tremendously polarized and somehow unstable. But I look over at Europe and think, oh no, you guys have way more potential for violence and war and everything than the United States.
Right. And part of the problem is that as they have been, shall we call it, scraping away at their roots, it's a lot like scraping away at your roots to drill for a cavity, you know, and they're getting to the point where, you know, some of the stuff is really starting to hurt, you know, some of, they're really starting to feel because they don't have what used to be the glue.
Yeah.
And, you know, Switzerland, someone just asked me today on Twitter, you know, about Switzerland, and I was saying it was a boring but predictable country. And they said, how could that be? And I said, they're working off the capital of their Christianity, which created, you know, a patchwork that's a lot like the American states, but even more divisive in a way, because they have Catholic cantons and they have Protestant cantons, and a Protestant cannot evangelize in a Catholic canton. You know, they have a very strict separations. Then they've got languages, and they've actually got four main languages. So they've got the German, but each German valley has a different version of Swiss German. So they also all learn the High German. And then they've got French and Italian and this weird little language called Romansh, which isn't spoken by that many people anymore. But it was the glue was their Reformation Christianity, which helped to bring it together and to solidify this thing. And then they also happen to be very good at you know, they have almost no natural resources there. They've got some, you know, ore in the mountains. They've got cows. They've got, you know, but it's essentially like a citadel, which is one of the reasons it's so impregnable, because like Georgia is more like a valley with two huge mountain chains, which means everybody on earth runs through it. So the Romans, the Greeks, the Mongols, you know, the Persians, the Turks, the Arabs have all come through here, the Russians, because it's a throughway from the Caspian Sea to the Black Sea. But Switzerland is more like a citadel with all the mountains kind of pushed up in the middle. And what's interesting about them is that they have almost no natural resources, none worth shouting about, but they're geniuses at turning what they have into gold. So they've got a lot of mountains, they've got a lot of milk from the cows on the mountains, and they make cheese out of it. And everybody knows about Swiss cheese. But not only that, then they started making another milk product, was to take the milk and add it to chocolate. And Swiss chocolate is legendary, you know, and there's so many different kinds besides just Nestle or something.
Even though cacao and sugar are definitely not from Switzerland.
Absolutely. And this is what they're great at, is taking a product from somewhere else and then adding value to it, shipping it back out. Based on one of their own products, you know. So, for instance, because of all the mountains, because of the Romantic movement, they were the first ones to set up tourism in the modern sense. Then, as people wanted to come there, this new railroad thing came along. So they started building railroads to get to the tourist spots like the Matterhorn. That made them very good as engineers, which they also applied to things like clockmaking. But also all those people traveling to Switzerland started noticing something interesting about their banking. And so all of these things, like I say, we're talking about a very few elements, unlike, say, California all by itself, which has all the elements you could possibly want in a country. And yet that makes Switzerland, I would say, probably the best and wealthiest country to live in the world. Hmm. I mean, they actually keep their money value down just so other people can afford some of their products. But the Dutch do that as well. Yeah. Evidently, yeah. The Dutch are brilliant at also taking products that are imported, doing something to them, and shipping them back out. And they are actually which is weird, the largest global importer-exporter in the world through shipping is America. That's obvious. Number two, not so obvious, the Netherlands.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they're
incredible,
you know,
for a tiny country.
Tiny, minuscule. And yet they've got all this stuff coming and going from Rotterdam. And they do things to it. They tweak it a little bit, or they add a little something and they ship it out. And this makes them unbelievably rich, you know. So that's Europe in a way. You've got all these tensions. Like, for instance, you didn't spend any time in Belgium, but you spent time in the Netherlands. As you know, the Netherlandish world is kind of its own weird thing. The French world is its own thing. And the place where they both meet and collide is called Belgium.
Yeah.
And you almost need that country in there to absorb the tension that is so great in culturally between those two cultures. And so Belgium is half Dutch speaking, half French speaking. And Brussels is this very weird polyglot city, not only having the European Union there, but just, I mean, walking down the street there, it was like English, French, German, Dutch, half a dozen Arab dialects, you know, Chinese, it just all of these languages in this little old city. And yet, in the center of the town, you could still believe this is just old school Europe with nice buildings and such.
I wonder about I wonder about how all of this has impacted, you know, what the I mean, the strange aspects about the collapse of the church in Europe. So one of the things that was interesting, you know, we stayed with Job, and I'm not going to try and say the Dutch name, towns and names, Vindonk would always say them perfectly, so I didn't have to, but we stayed with Job, and it was very interesting. There was, you know, obviously there were some old churches. There was the church that Job is going to now, and then not too far from Job's house, one of the Reformed churches was building a big new building for themselves. And I just by the looking at the steelwork that they were putting up, to me, it looked like the kind of not mega church in California standards, but no, probably a church of 1,000 to 2,000 people. And the architecture was not, you know, a historic church, you know, some of which we saw there, but the architecture was, it would have a big stage. It would probably have contemporary music. And so, you know, even in England, I spent one day sort of off the tour with some friends of mine who I had gotten to know in the Dominican Republic. They were missionaries there. They left the DR and they moved back to England, where they both got involved with churches, Christians Against Poverty, and were sort of, you know, right there at the ground floor. My friend was CEO of Christians Against Poverty, which has become a major organization in the UK, helping churches deal with, you know, help people who are poor. But yet they also at the same time helped plant a church, kind of a charismatic evangelical church. And so you see in Europe, both on one hand, the very hardy roots of historic Christianity in all of its diversity in different places, and also alongside of it, small emergences of, let's say, American-style evangelicalism. That's there too. All of that happening as only a maybe single digit or low double digit participating percentage of the population.
Right.
That a prevailing residue of Christendom that seems pervasive, not only in the architecture, not only in the history, but even in the culture and the values. Even as it's sort of distinct. I mean, the Dutchness, and they're both Catholic and Reformed, the German, and they're Catholic and Lutheran. You know, right. I didn't get to France, but and I didn't get to one of these years. I'd really love to get to Spain, because at least there's a country that I can speak the language in. But besides England, although that was fun in and of itself. So just the evolution of Christianity in Europe over the last 100 years is something worthy of a lot of reflection and a lot of thought.
Well, when you were in Northern Ireland, did you talk with anyone there about the collapse of Catholic Christianity in the Republic of Ireland? That happened very quickly.
So we were at Marcus Connolly. He's at this Bember Priory, and I did this event with Paul Kingsnorth, and actually had it was that also was very interesting, because obviously Northern Ireland, which, you know, obviously had that very tortured history, but now there are no border crossings between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, and it's very clear that, you know, there's a lot of economic vitality in Northern Ireland yet. So people live on both sides of the borders, commute both ways. And so in many ways, it's sort of a united Ireland in some ways, although you obviously have the pound and the euro that are sort of simultaneously coexisting. But the collapse of the church, not just the Catholic Church, but of course you have the Church of Ireland, which is sort of the counterpart to the Church of England that's in Ireland. And you have all of these other elements. And so actually the collapse of the church became a really interesting sub-conversation there because we sort of ran a big estuary thing. And so I was just kind of popping into all those little estuary groups. Many, many people talking about sort of the collapse of the church, disappointment in the church, corruption in the church. You know, in some ways, I'm sure it's quite distinct, but what happened in terms of the collapse of the church in Quebec versus the collapse of the church in Ireland. So I didn't have the sense that I knew much of anything about it, but I could tell this was an enormously significant, passage for the country in terms of their relationship with the church. And we're holding this event in this Catholic, you know, priory basically. And this priory that had been, it had been a, an Irish manor, and it had been bought by a Catholic order. And during the 60s and 70s, it was bought in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, had big Catholic music festivals. And then in the 80s, that started to recede. And now, you know, Marcus and others are trying to figure out, how do we use this space? And of course, John and I really encouraged them to think about more events. And I have to actually get back to Marcus on that because he wants me back next year. And it's like, well, am I going to, is Europe going to be an every summer thing for me? I don't know. But no. And it just strikes me that all over Europe, there are all of these little stories about sort of the collapse of participation in the church. And there's so much connected there with the church's relationship with political power historically, you know, and of course that makes the American story so very different because you have this ostensible separation of church and state in a deeply Protestant culture and nation.
Right.
And I guess in many ways for me going to Europe, it was just seeing signs of issues too large for me to really wrap my mind around them, but knowing they are deeply significant, deeply important, and are going to continue to be deeply formative of the church, the faith, and the future history of Europe.
Yeah. Well, you look at England, which used to be really a bastion of Christianity. And even after World War II, they seem to really still be Christians, but obviously there was some kind of rot that had set in, and you know, by the time of the Beatles and rock and sex, drugs, and rock and roll and all of that, things changed quite a bit. But they wouldn't have changed had they not been ready to change. I went to a couple of Anglican services in 1978. Which were in large, beautiful buildings and rather dull, you know. And I got the feeling that by that time, for so many people, unfortunately, what was there with the Christian faith, it was like the tide was really receding. And I'm told now that there are more Muslims in England than there are members of the Church of England.
Well, not members. I mean, because I saw this video before
right,
I went.
Right.
I saw this video. I mean, huge numbers of people in England are members.
Right.
But the number of people who actually bother to show up for a service is, you know. And then they have the huge challenge of they have these big, beautiful, historic buildings that, you know, you don't, like you said, in America, it's part of it. If you build it beautiful, people will want to keep it around in the future, whether or not they have any felt relationship with the people or the motivation that actually built the beautiful building. But then suddenly you have this challenge of how on earth are you going to spend the money to maintain all these structures, and what are you going to do with them? Because you're not going in there for worship.
Right, right. Well, many of them become museums, essentially. You know, places for tourists, you know, the best of them, which is sad. I mean, it's good on one hand. I really enjoy walking in old cathedrals, but at the same time, that isn't really the purpose of a church. And I think that later, when I went to, in that same trip, I was on my way to Le Brie in Switzerland, and I met people there who were English, and there still seemed to be a real robustness to their faith, even if it was somewhat embattled by the changes since the 60s. This was, again, 78, 79. But the changes, of course, kept coming. And I think that the British kind of succumbed to weird things like, well, Americanization is one thing. I mean, I remember once going there, what was it, 2012 or something, I was passing through, just looking around going like, where am I? This just feels like some big city in America with, you know, a few exceptions. Yeah. You know, there's some nice, you know, architecture here and there, but the people just look like this, you know, bunch of people, you know, and I realized, okay, well, here's a thing that seems to have worked. A lot of the men during this period had like closely cropped shaved head. I said, oh, I guess the skinheads won that one. So there's a bit of Englishness there. And that part came over to America and influenced people for a little while here. But I, you know, I looked around at the clothing, and it's just all the same kind of off the rack stuff that's made in China or Vietnam or someplace that you get, or, you know, India, that you get all over the world, which is now pretty much a universal thing. You know, you can, everybody seems to be wearing some sort of sports gear or something like that. And I find that here in Tbilisi as well. But in a way, I think what makes Tbilisi interesting for me is they got left behind because, you know, they were in the Soviet Union up until 91, and then they fell into a period of civil wars for the next 10 years or so. And then they had a revolution to try to change things around in 2004, but then that didn't end up so well. And so it wasn't until about 2012 here that they actually started modernizing in any sufficient way. And so in that interim period, the church had a way, because it had been squashed by the Soviets, it took on more meaning here for the average person. But I do think of the situation in Ireland, in Quebec, and I look around here and I say, I hope I don't see an absolute collapse of Christianity here the way we've seen it in those kinds of places.
Well, you know, part of when you have it's so funny, every now and then some citizen of the United Kingdom will. Another thing that struck me was everybody is very interested in American politics and has opinions about it, and fair enough. Right. But when I hear people who are subjects of the king going on about Christian nationalism in America, I just roll my eyes, because the degree to which we have any of it, it's an import, baby.
Right.
And Europe, the history of the weddedness of the power of the crown to the power of the cross, that long history, and what that, you know, what that has wrought. And I was, you know, right now, of course, there's this tide of curiosity and interest in orthodoxy. And I remember one person in a rebel wisdom campfire saying, well, maybe orthodoxy doesn't have a long history of collaboration with politics and bloodshed. And I thought, oh my, are you going to be in for a rude awakening if you read any history? And so part of, you know, in terms of part of the large conversation within Christianity and the church continues to be the questions of how the king and the crown continue to relate to each other. And then, of course, how democracy, which, you know, had its antecedents in Roman Catholic Synod and the conciliar movements, and mm-hmm. I guess probably some some comparable things in Orthodoxy, because those tensions have always been in Christianity right from the start. You had sort of apostolic leadership and apostolic succession versus, you know, the Council of Jerusalem and the Council of the Elders, and you sort of have these two, you know, one sort of, you know, you've got all those tensions. But of course, in America, you had, because there was right at the outset a degree of religious pluralism within Protestantism, which was what was in America. And then, of course, eventually the Catholics would come. And so America just said, you know, we're not going to have a state church. You could have, well, we're not going to have a federal church. You could have state churches, but those eventually went away. But in Europe, of course, you've got these state churches, and they're still around, and they're still, you know, some of the I had fascinating conversations in England and in Ireland with clergy. There was one person, he was a cleric from the Church of Ireland, which a Protestant denomination. And leaving the event, he said to me, he said, "Well, I'm a minister in the Church of Ireland." And he said, "If you had told me at the beginning of this event that people would have shared and talked about their religion in this space and talked about it transparently and honestly, I never would have believed you, but it happened here." And to me, that said a lot about how fresh wounds are and how difficult barriers are between erected from all of this history for people to now, in the context of what's happening in contemporary religion around the world, in the context of course, the impact of American Christianity everywhere, how complex this conversation in churches in Europe is going to be.
And of course, you and I both can look at the American situation and go like, yeah, please don't take it all from us.
Yeah. Well, and your story is so interesting, and I don't know how many people on my channel will remember. You've talked about it before, but I mean, you in some ways grew up right there at the heart of what became sort of the rootstock of so much of contemporary American evangelicalism.
Yeah, well, it turned out later I didn't grow up as a Christian at all. And I was kind of a lost child, listening to rock and roll music. But even by 1970, when I was 15 years old, I was getting the feeling that it was letting me down. You know, the little religion I had going of meaningful lyrics and stuff was already being replaced by, I don't know, Carpenters and the Jackson 5 and such like that. And so I became a Christian. And what turned out to be, and this was while I was in high school at the age of 15, as I look back on it, the Ground Zero Jesus People group. Right. There were figures in the group who had been there in 1967. I became a Christian in 1970. But people who had been affected by the group or connected to the group in 67, 68, like guys like Lonnie Frisbee, who drifted off, people who went up to Seattle, Washington, people who inhabited so many areas of the San Francisco Bay, like we were connected to what was called the Christian World Liberation Front, but it was also Jack Sparks and the Write On magazine, later became Radix. Yeah. And well, they were out of Berkeley, so they had to give themselves that kind of name. But interestingly enough, later, Jack Sparks became Orthodox, you know, way ahead of the curve here. Yep. You know, like back in the I think it was the 80s or late 80s, early 90s or so. But then our group kind of got sucked into charismatic evangelicalism. And so we started eventually by the middle of the 70s having these large meetings. And, you know, it was all about, you know, feeling the spirit and this sort of stuff. And I'm not going to take too long a detour on that. But I was feeling the end of it when I kind of discovered Labrie and through a series of choices, ended up going to Swiss Labrie in 1978, which is one of the best things I ever did, because it was it did several things for me. And one of them was, besides all the stuff related to my faith and my thinking and researching the arts and the rest of it, one of the things it really did was it connected me to Europe. And I needed that as an antidote for so much American Christianity. Because, and I saw this even when we met in Landau, Germany. It was amazing how easily I could talk with the Germans there. And, you know, suddenly we'd be talking about what happened in World War II. You know, that one thing I did notice about Europeans, and this is a generalization, and I'm sure you could find counterfactuals on this, but one of the things I noticed, and I do notice every time I travel, when I'm talking to puppeteers or people in the arts or musicians or, you know, various friends, there is much more connection to history, to philosophy, to, you know, trying to, there's still an idea of education there, you know, whether it's in France, Germany, the Netherlands, England. Not that everybody is like this, but among the people I traveled around with, much more so than one would find in America, where, as someone once said, you know, you ask us about history, and most people, Americans can't, don't know much at all, the average American. But he asked them about the geography of Westeros, or, you know, who should have died in the snap in the Infinity Wars. And Americans, you know, how many Kardashian sisters there are and what they should be doing. You ask Americans those kind of media-driven questions, they know everything about it. Whereas Europeans are a lot less knowledgeable. Here in Georgia, it's like when I tell Georgians about what an American geek is like, that, you know, we get the Marvel movies and Star Wars and stuff here, and they go to it and they come out like I did in 1977 when I saw Star Wars, and they either go like, ah, oh, that was good, or they go like, eh, that wasn't so good. But they don't live for it. It's not their mythology at all. They're happy to have their own Georgian roots or to be curious about what's going on in the West. But consequently, I have great conversations here quite often with all sorts of people, younger students in their early 20s, all the way up to people in their 60s and 70s. It's like, that's one of the reasons I love being here, is that it's open in terms of conversation. I have to watch myself when I get to Georgian politics, just because I don't know that much about it. I mean, I can make my stab in the dark, but I wait quite a while before I make any comments, you know, with someone about anything like that. But when it comes, you know, they're very curious about what is happening over in America. Yeah, you know, yeah. I remember walking through the mountains here. Just, there was this mountain right behind my house where I used to live. There still is one here. But I was on this trail, and there was this old guy who was a translator. And I'd read actually some of his books. And so I'd see him every now and then sitting on a bench up on the mountain, and we'd stop and talk for a bit. And we got to talking about Trump and what was going on in America and such. Not the kind of conversation, though, that you would have either in America or Western Europe. This was a thing because these people didn't have these immediate knee-jerk reactions to these kinds of things. They are on a totally different plane. But then a woman stops and hears me talking, and she's saying, so what do you think is going, you know, and I'm sitting there saying to myself, I'm on a trail in the Caucasus Mountains, and I've stopped a man I've seen here, sitting here before. We're having an intellectual conversation, and this random woman overhears us and stops and wants to know about the American situation. I go like, this is great. You know, it's like, this would rarely happen in such a way in America. You know, we just have a lot of other things to talk about.
Well, Americans would never have any knowledge or question about anything beyond America, even if, I mean, one of the things that struck me too was people would, obviously, they'd want to talk about America and American politics, and their impressions of America, of course, because they're not here, and they're just reading through this media lens that everyone here is reading each other through. You just had the sense that America is so polarized, and it's so crime ridden, and it's so dangerous that, you know, you must be very brave people to live there. And it's like, the Americans feel the same way about most of the rest of the world.
Oh yeah, yeah. I had a woman in Alaska. She was the person who ran a tour company. She was taking Europeans and Asians all over to see eagles and stuff with her jet boats. And I told her, yeah, I'm going back to France this summer and do some more research on puppetry. And she put her hand on my wrist and said, now be careful, Bern. It's really dangerous there. And I'm sitting there going like, have you looked at any of our statistics lately? But you do get the same kind of reverse thing here. And I've had some of these things come up where people will just, it doesn't happen in Georgia. They tend to have a more romantic image of America here. But I do notice among other Western Europeans and such, and some of the people who write to me, you know, comments on my videos or on Twitter or something, they'll say something like, yeah, but is, you know, what are the statistics like, you know, it was someone actually said, you know, America, I was gave them four choices in a poll of, would you rather live in an interesting, a predictable but boring country? And I meant like Switzerland, and interesting. Amusing but chaotic country, and I meant America. And then at the bottom I said, there was another one, which is where I consider Georgia to be, of unpredictable but absolutely interesting. You know, and the bottom one was chaos but fascinating. And they were saying, well, that's America. And I said, no, America's a number two. We're mildly amusing, and things get confusing sometimes. And what you're doing is you're thinking south side of Chicago or Baltimore, whereas most places you go in America, it's going to be really safe, you know, and there will be places you should get some information about, but a lot of people just don't see that, you know. It's just, but you know, there was a weird thing that happened here it was in the middle of 2020 in the summer. People were just starting to walk on the same mountain again on these trails, and some poor Australian woman got killed, which is of course terrible. And they eventually caught the kind of crazy Georgian guy who did it. Now the expats here went insane. They were saying, Georgia is ruined. How are we ever going to live here again? You know, and I thought to myself, wait a minute. And I actually wrote this in some Facebook group. I said, like, you know, I used to live in New York City. Do you have any idea how many people would die every day there? You know, Georgia's not ruined. It's just had one incident that isn't very good at all. But it's, you know, terrible. But. You know, that doesn't make everything bad suddenly. But, you know, people, Americans and other people, get this kind of like nervousness, not realizing their own country is so much worse. And in fact, one of the things I often tell people is I realize that here in Georgia, there's very little mental illness. And I remember I was sitting on the metro platform, and you know, there's that little zone in subway stations that you're not supposed to get too close to the cars. Well, I was kind of looking over, looking down the tracks. I was near the end, and then I suddenly had this New York moment, like, "Ooh, I better watch out. Someone might push me in." So I backed up, and then I looked at everyone on the platform and said, "None of these people are going to push me in," you know. And you know what I just heard? How many people have been pushed in front of a subway train in New York City since the beginning of the year? 129 this year.
Holy cow.
And there's something radically... See, the Europeans don't have this level of mental illness, yes, and criminality that we do. I mean, they've got plenty of crime, yeah, and they've certainly got mental illness, but not on the scale that you find. It's, I mean, even Sacramento would probably be way off the charts for any European place. You know, Sacramento isn't anywhere really, you know. But, you know, just looking at the folks that sleep on your steps and such, you know. But what I realized was the big difference was that here, everybody knows where their family is.
Yeah. There's a rootedness.
They're probably living with them. They were probably raised by their grandmother. They know where their clan is. They know where their village is. So if worse comes to worse, I mean, people here have been terribly poor, but never starving, because all the trees in the city have nuts and fruits and grapevines. You know, there's just fruit everywhere. And the countryside is like that. It's just a tremendously fertile land. But I think that one of the things I get from Europe are these things that reach back into the past. Some of them are really bad, you know, certain kinds of social situations that have gone on for years, whether related to money, which they often do, or land use, or, countries that hate each other and this sort of thing. But the thing I get is that, you know, this history, it's all alive. And Americans tend to snip it as much as possible. And in a sense, we live for the self. And so we don't have a history. We don't have, you know, our relationships with our families aren't that good. You know,
and that tends to impact the how Christianity and the church works. And so that version of Christianity that is very much centered on the self, of course, the Pentecostal movement begins in America, the Jesus people, and the this brand, this style of worship that is very much inward, it's ecstatic, it's in the moment, it's personal, it's not tied to tradition or history. You don't have the sense that you are a link in a great chain that connects, right, that connects all the way back to, whoever, Jesus or Moses or Muhammad or, whoever is the core, Martin, of your connection. You don't connect to God through history. You connect to God through, through the psyche, through the self. And, mm-hmm, and of course that type of religion has been tremendously popular but that type of religion is in many ways continuing to impact Europe as, I would imagine, globalization, which is, it cuts off people at the roots. So when I was, the day we arrived in London was a huge festival. It was festival, and it was mostly, it was sort of transported from Jamaica. And so the subways were just full of people wearing Jamaican colors and Jamaican outfits and festival type things. And it's like, okay, then you also in England then have the connection to, first England colonized the world, and now the world is colonized. Now the world is returning the favor.
Right, right. Well, they are getting the back end on their colonization for sure.
Yeah.
You know, and I think go ahead.
No, I'm curious what some of your thoughts are now about the German festival a couple of months later, and about the meaning of that event. And because, Cassidy just got married. So, mm-hmm, we don't have the videos from there. They took extensive videos from the festival, and they come out at some point. We have had the Thunder Bay videos that we've put out there. But I mean, the German festival was a fascinating event. And I'm curious about some of your reflections on it since
I particularly enjoyed it. Now, there was this kind of squall of a dark cloud that passed overhead related to the implications that someone there was thinking we were some sort of very strange group, which we weren't.
Well, we were strange, but we weren't harmful.
But apart from that, I was very impressed by the quality of the conversations, the quality of the dialogue. And even though, it wasn't a huge festival, everyone who was there because they wanted to be there. which you don't get at a lot of these events. Sometimes people end up going because everyone's going. You know, the bigger they get, the more that takes over. But here, everyone was here because they made an effort to come. And that, to me, spoke volumes. And I just had many conversations, which I appreciated. And in fact, I'm thinking of doing something different but similar here. And I'm thinking of inviting people, renting a few, putting my reservation down on several Airbnbs and inviting a limit of 12, 13 people to come. And then for a week, and half the week would be going to different artistic events, cultural events, meeting people who create things and do things, puppeteers and dancers and musicians and things like this. And then the second half of the week would be to do the same thing, rent a cluster of Airbnbs in a small village. I already have the whole thing picked out in my mind, and bring everyone up there. But now, you know, now it's time to talk and to have people do things like get together, talk, maybe just send out people, you know, why don't you two go this way? And why don't you two this? There's so many different ways to walk there. Why don't you go this way? Why don't you go this way? And then come back with the results of those discussions and talk. And then maybe one day where everyone goes out alone for a few hours, you know, and then another day where we all go out together. And the nice thing is there's so many beautiful, absolutely mind-blowing places to walk in such a short place that I think that sort of thing, and I'm thinking of it because my own burden, shall we say, to put it in Christianese, is for some sort of cultural renewal, you know, and to get people thinking about those things. And I think, you know, the prices would be probably pretty cheap. The only price that would be expensive would be the airplane here, you know, from wherever. And even then, like Teddy from Israel wants to come, his airfare isn't going to be much at all because Israel is not very far from Georgia. And in fact, he's thinking of coming up at some point in the near future. So, but I really think, and plus I've really been meeting some interesting people the last, ever since I went to Prague earlier this year, I've really met some interesting people, and I would like to introduce some of my Georgian friends to the Americans, because I think there would be a very interesting cross-pollination there. And people who are open to a dialogue. And it wouldn't be a kind of an estuary-related event. That is to say, it wouldn't be under official estuary auspices, but it would totally be the same people. Just an idea, you know.
I think it's a great idea.
Because I think that also one of the things I learned from going to Libri in Switzerland is that, for instance, it was the ride up the mountains that really got my juices flowing from the first. Just like looking over these super steep cliffs with bus drivers who can take a hairpin turn. It's just like, where am I going? And Georgia does that to you. It just gives you, it's like it just turns you inside out. And you need that when you travel in order to use travel as, I think, a way to get inside of things, which ultimately, I think I said this too during when we were staying at that Airbnb. I think the point of travel is ultimately to get back to your own bed. But with the experiences you've had measured and weighed along the way. You know, because you want your own life to be, you know, fuller and meaningful. And at the same time, traveling is great. I often look at traveling when I take, not only did I go to Landau, but I went to visit friends further north and then went to visit another friend in Berlin. So it was like a little German trip for me. And earlier, I spent 3 weeks in Prague doing puppet stuff, but also just looking at art and buildings and things like that. And I look at trips, a good trip, as being like life. It's like a miniature of life. You start off, there's that where are we going? What's this going to be like? Then you get going. There'll be times and it's just utterly boring. And pretty, you know, you're going like, what am I doing here? There'll be other times you're just like, what is that? What is that? Who are these people? And you'll meet different, you'll be in different situations. And then there comes a time somewhere near the end, which is like the end of life, which is you start realizing this is going to end. And then at the end, you get on the final plane and you go home and you hope you're going to land properly and it all works out. And that to me is what good travel is to come back, as T.S. Eliot says, and to know the place you started for the first time. You know, so I think that is what's good. My biggest regret from this is that I didn't have a chance to really sit down and talk with you. And I knew I wouldn't, because you're on the Van Donk Express.
indeed I was.
Yeah, and when you guys left in the middle of the night, because we're trying to make a Job says, are you, did someone tell you what was going on? I said, I was asleep going, what, huh? And he said, yeah, we're leaving. And I said, what?
it was insane. Yeah. Van Donk was like, if we leave right now, we can make that ferry. And of course, at that point, so then of course, I've told this story before, you know, we get into the car and okay, we're gonna drive through the night, so we're gonna have to take shifts driving. And okay, I'm an easy sleeper, so I'll take the first shift sleeping, so I'll sleep a couple hours and I'll wake up and drive. And I sleep a little while and I wake up and I say, John says, you want the good news or the bad news? I said, oh crap. Give me the bad news first. I didn't buy us ferry tickets from Holland to England. I bought us ferry tickets from England to Holland. And they're non-refundable. And okay, what's the good news? Well, we're going back to the Netherlands. Thanks, John.
For more herring.
We're gonna spend the night in this car.
As soon as I saw you guys and some of the conversations with John and you, I said, yeah, I know what's going on here. John can talk Dutch, but he's totally American, you know. And Americans love to travel and not waste any time. Yeah. And one thing I've learned over my many years of traveling, waste some time. Yeah. You put some space in there where you can just walk around a city or, you know, go walking in it. Find a place to stay like Hallstatt, Austria, where you can just, there's nothing to do there but to just appreciate the lake, appreciate the Bein House, the Bone House, where they've had the skulls of the people who used to live there with their names painted on them, you know, where you can go in and see the old, you know, the icons that have that were made by the silver workers in the area, and that this was their mine, or go to the salt mine. All of these are, you know, I would do this on my puppet trips, but I'd get there and it's nothing to do with anything. This is just a few days to rest and enjoy where I am. And I've learned that Americans don't like stopping, and they like to go and go and go.
when the first event I did do once I started making videos was 2 days at my sister's kind of Airbnb in Connecticut. And all we did for those 2 days was just sit in comfortable rooms and eat good food and talk. And that's all we did. And that's all you need. Those were delightful. And in Germany, yeah, it was, you know, it's sort of the event sort of reminded me of church campouts in the 70s, where, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of people were camping at the venue. And, right. You know, the drought lifted when we got there, and there was a deluge.
Oh, it was pouring for that first night when the guys were out there in their tents and such.
Oh. But it was just a wonderful time to sit down. And, you know, as when the videos do come out, you know, you'll see the talks and everything, but right. an event like that is, the talks are the talks are fun and they're fine, and in a sense that's part of why people gather, but the main event is what's happening around the meals and in between the talks and late into the night at a fireplace, or and all of the individual relationships that are being built. And that's the, you know, that's really the reason to go to these things. And Thunder Bay was the same way. Justin Wells, who was just actually at Living Stones last week, he came with Vindunk last Sunday, but who came to the, you know, he was in Greece filming a Hollywood film and then came up to Landau for the event. And, you know, he's just like, yeah, people have come here to talk and to meet each other and to make friends and to, and that was really the heart of the event and the real reason to go. And, you know, people were moved quite deeply. And so it was really.
Well, some of the things I learned at LaBrie was that conversation goes well with eating.
Yeah.
And we would have these different kinds of conversations, but a couple of times a week, there'd be what we call formal conversations where people, do you have anything to discuss? A bit like an estuary thing, different rules, but you know, we'd be eating and we spend an hour and a half eating or so. And then there'd be these interesting discussions on what someone had been learning or during that week. But also there was a way that LaBrie was open to questions, particularly, they still are, but particularly in the 60s and 70s. And I arrived there near the end when the campfire was going down and you just had the glow of the coals. But it was just that all questions were open and you could put them on the table. And as someone once said, all questions are open, but the answers may not be warm and immediate. You know, it's just like, but let's take them. And I get the feeling that something of what's happening now, the best of it, has a lot of that attitude. And in fact, I just invited someone. I've been kind of thinking, okay, I want to do a few more interviews. And I'm starting to think now of the people I've known from LaBrie. And one of the people I just contacted is a pastor of a church in Basel, Switzerland. He's an American. His name is Ellis Potter. And he was a Buddhist monk before he became a Christian. Very fascinating outlook on the world. So I wanted to interview him on my channel. And he just looks like he agreed to it. He said he was very honored. And I mentioned to him, you know, what's going on some of our channels here reminds me in a certain way of what's going on, what happened in the 60s and 70s at LaBrie as far as open questions and such like that. And I think that's the best thing. And then to, as you pointed out in your video today, to get this thing beyond the screen, out into the world, to create not one thing, but many things.
Yeah.
You know, I often think of it from the perspective of the arts and creativity. And I look at whether it's something like the Surrealist movement or the arts and crafts movement in England at the end of the 19th century, or the C.S. Lewis and the Inklings. And they're all very different institutions, but the world was affected by creative people getting together and sharing their visions with each other and then going out and creating things that kind of hovered around certain ideas. You know, and now we're so atomized that creative people don't know how to do that anymore. So that's one of the things I think about, you know, it's just like how to bring people together to share creativity, to, because when you share, you can't help but kind of something spills over from one to the other, you know, and that is what is needed. And I'm thinking in terms of the long view rather than anything immediate. You know, it's like, yeah, okay, the world could blow up, but I'm not going to worry about that.
You can't stop it. So no, and I think you're right. And when I think about the Inklings and Lewis and Tolkien, the what they left behind, and in a sense what functioned in the way that the internet videos and conversations and still books too are functioning now, that's functioning analogous to it. But if you read something like Sheldon Vanocken's A Severe Mercy, or You talk to people who've been to La Brie, or the what was in the books, what Lewis wrote and what Tolkien wrote, you know, helped to energize and go out. But it was the relationships, it was the conversations. That's where the life transformation happens. And I think in the 60s and 70s, at least in America, and perhaps still in some places in Europe, churches were those spaces where some of these things could happen. You know, you also had festivals and concerts and just meetings in coffee shops or cafes or wherever our campuses. But, you know, today it's helpful. It's important to remember that in some ways the videos are analogous to, let's say, the books for Lewis, but that the videos are just sort of the record of what's going on. And the real mm-hmm. transformation is not going to happen with our eyes on a video screen or our ears to the podcast, but with our eyes and ears to each other, right, in how that forms us. And the relationships, you know, in some ways, I just kind of put together a little video about, you know, my relationship with Jacob, who, of course, Jacob catches, you know, a lot of attention because of the kinds of things that Jacob does. But it's the videos can carry the relationship to a degree, but it's going to have to be a real relationship. And it's always the relationships that are transformative, much more than just the message via a book or a video or a podcast.
Right. Well, that's also why I concentrate on being here and meeting people and inviting people over for conversations, putting different people together and seeing how the mix works and things like that. By the way, this is related to a lot of the other things you do on the channel, but not necessarily directly related to this conversation, except it's about the arts. But I just put on Twitter a note to you to go check this video out that I just put on. One of the people, a musician that I've followed for many years, is Nick Cave. And he started off as perhaps the most rageful of all the punks in the late 70s, early 80s. And I've got videos on my How We Got Here series that show him just rather ferocious. Later, he kind of came to what I would almost call a platonic view of Christianity. And he started to take it seriously by the end of the 80s. And his life has taken different turns. Up and down. Then in the last like 5 years or so, two of his sons have died.
Oh my.
And he just put out a book of interviews with him called Faith, Hope, and Carnage. And yeah. I'm in the middle of reading the book. It's absolutely amazing because the interviewer, who is not at all a Christian, is asking him, so do you believe now? And he's going like, well, yeah, I do. You know, I go to church now, and at the same time, he's still wrestling. You know, just imagine losing two children in the space of a few years. And but I highly recommend. So he's also just put out videos of some of the recent interviews he's done, and I put one of them he just put it out on his channel today, and I put one out there for people to look at. But I would recommend it because, in a way, even though he isn't part of, you know, this little corner of the internet, what he's been doing absolutely is. Mm. And he's wrestling with the belief in God. He's wrestling with these things. And I would put him somewhere over a little bit beyond, closer to Christianity, beyond the Tom Holland camp. That is to say, he certainly believes in God. He certainly believes in these things, but and he'll say, like, I don't understand how. He said if a person was to lose their children and not go seeking the meaning and to discover the meaning of God, they are a stronger man than I am. So I just recommend that. I think you would get, he's got several interviews that he's done from earlier this year that are, if you just look up Nick Cave and you'll find interview and find some of his music, and his music is beautiful now. He's really been wrestling with things for quite a long time. But if you compare it to what he first did, It was like he has lyrics in the first year is like fingers down the throat of love. You know, it's just like he's belching the word love out. I mean, just the most scabrous sound you could possibly imagine. And but then he started changing by the end of the decade. And I kind of felt like he would, because he was so honestly, you know, wrestling with just the meaning of things in those songs. And he was a junkie and alcoholic and all this other stuff. And essentially, you're looking at a man now who's been pretty completely broken, and all he has left is God. And so I highly recommend the interviews with him recently and the book, Faith, Hope, and Carnage.
Faith, Hope, and Carnage. Wow, what a title.
Yeah.
What a title. Yeah, there's a lot of despair around with respect to the loss of faith, but one of the things that people seldom appreciate is something Chesterton points out. Well, you know, faith is lost and refound again and again and again, and there is sort of a cycle where you do feed off the capital of past generations, and then you spend it down, and then you get down to the bottom, and that of course is where, you know, you'll find the limits of your own resources, and you'll begin to reach out to resources that are beyond yourself. And that, you know, one of the ways to talk about when you come to Christ is when you realize that all you need is need. And in that way, you know, he builds you up, and then, you know, you just have this cycle throughout history that you see again and again in Christianity of loss and then restoration and just around and around. So there will, we will continue to find fresh converts in surprising places who have had lives of pain and loss. That's been the story of Christianity all the way through.
And I think this time is a very fascinating time. Many people are looking at this as a very dark, chaotic time. But to me, out of that darkness and chaos is where you find the new searching, where you find the honesty.
Right.
And I'm not sad at all for that.
Yeah. Well, and that's Tolkien and Lewis, of course, you know, both come out of the battlefields of the First World War. And Lewis, after the death of his mother, he was a very smart 13-year-old when he embraced atheism and had, you know, the great knock, and was the kind of materialist atheist that Sam Harris, rational materialist atheist that Sam Harris could only dream of becoming. And, right. You know, then the war, the relationships, you know, then over to Cambridge and meeting Tolkien and Dyson, and then the discovery of all of this, and then leaving an inheritance that generations have been continuing to mine and be blessed by. So, and I think we will continue to see that in this meaning crisis, because, you know, the meaning crisis is not new. And I think part of the reason Tolkien and Lewis are so helpful with respect to it is because they, of course, were dealing with the meaning crisis that was the collapse of Christianity as seen in the First World War.
Yes. And essentially that whole middle section of the 20th century is just, you know, what I sometimes tell people is what I fear is that we do the farce version of the same thing in the 21st century. That is to say, you know, you look around and you say, where are the leaders? Really hard to find. People, you know, the 20th century just seemed filled with all these legendary names, good and bad. But when you look around now, and who are the names that have, you know, with ideas and substance, and, you know, who have this thing. And so, someone has said to me, well, we will eventually find out. And he says, like, yeah, but no one had to say that in the middle of the 20th century.
No.
You had a pretty good idea of who was who.
Well, part of the problem is we have these screens are just an enormous distraction, and they highlight all of the wrong signals. You know, the Kardashians are in some ways the the epitome of this. Right. So these people are famous for being famous and for being, you know, and for being sexy. And then, you know, of course, Kanye comes around and says the most obvious thing, which is that, you know, my ex-wife, which is clearly a woman he continues to love, is valued for her booty. And mm-hmm. and she is also the mother of our children. And, you know, so even in the chaos of Kanye, you can right. already see the contours of reclamation. And even though Kanye himself is a ball of chaotic distraction.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's getting late here. In the middle of the night. Not really, but late. Yeah. So, well, I've enjoyed talking as usual.
Usual, Bird. It's good to see you. Yeah. And again, for me too, it was lovely to finally meet you in the flesh. And I wish we could have had more time of just you know, one of the nicest times was just that dinner that we had in Landau, just the Doc and Job. Until right. of course we I thought that John had all of those arrangements all set. And he's like, no, we don't have any train tickets back to we don't have any train tickets to London.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't. Yeah. And Burns like, you don't.
This is 2022. Do you have any idea what's going on in Europe right now? Well, I do hope to see you in Europe again someday. Yeah, don't feel like you have to rush back, because you need to take care of the things you need to take care of. But I would really love to see you here one day. I think you'd be really surprised by this place.
Well, because I'd love to see Tbilisi, yeah.
Off the beaten path, but it's also has, I mean, you see, you know, there'll be gallerias here and, you know, people have computers and smartphones and everything like that. Nevertheless, it's in a different zone and there are hopes here. I, you know, I'm going to, what is it? Puppet show 2 days from now, 3 days from now. Then I'm going to, and that's a friend's puppet show of Don Quixote. And then I'm going to, another couple of friends have a ballet troupe, and it's a pretty good one too. And they're playing on the 15th. And that's one of the things I love about being here. I was taken by my friends who do hand shadow puppets to villages here. They're doing them for the shows. And one village was on the Azerbaijani border, which was also right near the Armenian border. And of course, they hate each other and they fight each other over bits of land, but here they don't. And so I went to an Azerbaijani village and then I went to an Armenian village with my friends. And it was just so fascinating. And I feel so fortunate to have all this, but I really wish I could share what the cultural world is here, because it's such a small, strange island. But that's the reason I came, yeah. is to learn what this island is and to see if there's anything that I can pass on to the bigger world.
Yeah. So. There are so many beautiful, small, strange islands in the world. It's amazing.
Yeah.
So, okay. All right. Good talking to you, Bern.
Look forward to seeing this someday on your channel.
And all right. Very good.
Take care.
Okay.
God be with you.